on the custom control, custom duty, and custom amendment bill. Let me start by apologizing to our visitors and representatives, because the law in routine, we underestimated the gravity of issues that we're going to deal with before the public hearing. But probably you'll understand that we're trying to do as much as we can as Parliament now. But more bills than we had anticipated because we had to squeeze everything. So I just want to extend, on behalf of the committee, our apologies to say we're not by any means seeking to send a message that your contribution in this process is less important. Not at all. I just wanted to make that admission up front. And I thought I did not even consult my committee members on this one, because this is a very, very serious and important matter that impacts on the economy, jobs, and everything. And it's a process that has been in the pipeline for quite a considerable time, or an amount of time. I thought we will request first, before consulting that, that Cosilo and your team, Commissioner Tsuga, just take us a little 10 to 15 minutes journey of where we come from with this group and we take presentation. I'm sorry, Constructor. Is that okay with you? Just to help us reach it. Do you have a slide presentation or can just do it from where you are? Yeah, okay, good. Thank you. For our own education.
Thank you, Chairman, for the opportunity. Yes, normally, Chair, we will sort of respond at the end, you know, after we've heard presentations, but I think it would be a good thing if we just recap, perhaps for the benefit of the committee and everybody, perhaps a little bit around the process that was followed. because I read the, when we got most of the presentations yesterday and we had an opportunity to go through them, and I must say I was a bit really taken by surprise, you know, if you look at the sort of the tenure of the, especially the presentation of SARF.
Can I request that? I thought what I was requesting just to update us,
yeah,
but not your reaction to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'll do that. But I think the starting point there, Che, is that that it seems that the thinking is that there was not really sufficient consultation from a SARS point of view. And I'd like to recap as far as that is concerned. Look, the rewrite process is not something that started a few weeks or a few months ago. This is a process that have started many, many years ago, at least five, 6 years ago. It started in already in 2007, 2008. During the first phases, we did not do external communication. We mainly consulted with governmental stakeholders to prepare the ground for ourselves. But the first bill was put out for comment in 2009, the first split versions of the two bills, the customs control bill and the customs duty bill. And we allowed a period of 4 months for consultation. We put it out on the 30th of October 2009, and we allowed in 4 months as far as that is concerned for consultation. And we got many comments in the process. The second point, Chair, is that what we also did and what we not normally follow actually from a tax point of view is we took these bills also through the NEDLAC process. Normally we don't take the tax bills through the NEDLAC process. We almost spent 3 years in the NEDLAC process on these bills with consulting with labor, business and government on the issues. I think we had at least about 6 meetings. A report ultimately of about 35 pages was produced. And there was only really one area of disagreement amongst the partners, and that was the issue of the inland terminals. That was the issue of disagreement by business. I don't think there were any issues of disagreement from the labor process. Then, almost parallel with that process, we released a second batch of the bills in April and May 2011 for another round of comment to the general public. And we allowed extensions as well as far as that process is concerned. We also had many workshops with government stakeholders. We took our SACU partners. We had at least three sessions with them on the bills. Until eventually the bills were sort of pre-certified in February 2013 by the state law advisors. Then we had another round of consultation, taking it through the governmental clusters, cluster meetings. We took the bill to cabinet. And then ultimately, after all those processes, the bill was published again on the website on the 21st of August 2013. We didn't publish it for comment again for the general public at that stage, but we published it for information so that people can start preparing themselves for the processes that lie ahead. Because, Chair, you can't every time and open it now for comment when, for the public, because at some stage you need to draw a line then so that we can move it then forward through the parliamentary process. Ultimately, the bills were finally certified by the law advisors in September, and then there was a final certification by the state, but by Parliament's law advisors in October, and then ultimately the bills were tabled on the 24th of October in Parliament. Now, Chair, I think we need to separate the two processes of consultation, the process of consultation with SARS and then the process of consultation, the parliamentary process. That's a process that SARS does not have any control over, that's Parliament's process. But we feel as far as the SARS process is concerned, we spend years on these bills consulting and trying to get comments as far as that is concerned. Obviously, there are areas that you then don't agree on, and then you take the matter forward, and then ultimately a call needs to be made on these issues. But Chair, I think there's no, in having had a look at the presentations, there's no real new issues that almost came forward.
Yeah.
As far as the process is concerned.
I wanted you just to take us
okay.
in terms of the process.
Good.
We'll allow the presenters to make...
Okay.
SARS will have its own opportunity to respond at a particular period. I wanted just to bring members up to speech in terms of the process itself. But in terms of your responses to the presentations and all that, it's a separate matter because... Otherwise, it's like we want you to influence the committee on how you should actually respond and interact with the presentation from the stakeholders. So I thought I should just stop you from there. It was meant to update and to keep us alive as members on this particular matter. I have, honorable members, the following organizations that are going to make presentation is the South African Clothing and Textile Workers Union, SACTU, and the General Secretary, I hope you'll introduce his delegation and also tell us how you're going to lead how you're going to go about the presentation itself. After that, we'll have Women and New Zealand. And then we'll then take Chamber of Commerce and Industry. And after all this presentation, the committee will enter into discussions with yourselves questions of clarity and so on and so forth, and comments. So I just want to welcome you once again, Andre, and your team. Thank you very much.
Just, it's not a point of order, but just to remind you that we had an issue with regard to the agenda last time. You're 45 minutes behind schedule, so if you can ask them if they can save us 5 to 6 minutes on each presentation, you won't have the same problem as last time.
Chair, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Andre Creel. I am the General Secretary of the Southern African Clothing and Textile Workers Union. We're here to do a submission on behalf of our organization. We're not here, even though we're affiliated to COSATU, to make a submission on behalf of COSATU. We'll try our best to be brief and to the point. We were allocated 30 minutes. We were here on time. We understand your pressures. So with the greatest respect, we will try our best, but we have to be afforded the opportunity with your permission, Chair. Without much ado, we're here to speak largely in support of the bills. We want to give you some evidence that will graphically illustrate the problem that we have. And as I said, we'll try to not embroider too much on general issues, but we'll try to be very specific. So we'll try to accommodate the member. The colleagues who are here from our organization is, on my left here, Simon Eppel, who's a researcher in our organization. We have Nonleba Mklauli here, who's also a researcher, and then at the back here is Veronica Williams, who is the National Membership Officer of our union. The presentation will be done by Simon, so without much ado, I'll hand over to him.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. As my General Secretary has said, we are in the main here to support many of the measures that are included in the bills. I think our intention is to sketch some of the justifications for those measures. Listening to National Treasury, we are sure that National Treasury is undoubtedly pleased that there are very progressive measures in the bills, and we are equally sure that National Treasury finds it in their interest to best enable SARS to do its work so that SARS can enable other functions of state, whether it's industrial functions or revenue collection functions, to work as effectively as possible. Honourable Members, just a brief introduction to the Southern African Clothing and Textile Workers Union. We have about 100,000 members. These are generally found, overwhelmingly found in the manufacturing industry, manufacturing clothing, textiles, footwear and leather goods. These are workers who, ordinary workers who work in factories, cutting cloth, making various fabrics of various kinds, sewing garments. The shirt I have on here today was manufactured by workers of Stonesborough from Parliament, just down the road off Buitenkant. The shirt the General Secretary is wearing is made slightly, if you have a stronger arm and can throw the stone a little bit further, it may hit the house of Manatic down the road. These are our members, ordinary workers in the country. Yet these members of ours are intimately affected by trade, as is obvious. And in particular by illicit and illegal trade. This is not a contentious issue. It's something that all the social partners, government, business and labor all agree upon, that customs fraud is potentially the major driver of job losses in the clothing, textile, footwear and leather sector, and that it is increasingly a major challenge to industrialization more generally in South Africa and other industries in South Africa too. So in other words, if we can address the problem of customs fraud properly, we have the possibility of remediating many of the challenges which currently exist, which include things like job losses. In the clothing, textile, footwear and leather sector in South Africa, we have roughly 130,000 employees found in the formal as well as the informal sector. Government has identified the CTFL industry as a key driver for job creation. That's because it creates many jobs. The clothing industry, clothing sector, has the largest or it's the most labor-intensive of manufacturing industries. The clothing and textile industries have very, very large multiplier effects as far as the manufacturing sector is concerned. And these are also very cost-effective ways for creating jobs, given the cost, particularly in the clothing sector, the cost of machinery, the cost of capital, and the cost of labor, which is the lowest in manufacturing in the country. The clothing and textile industry is also a significant employer of women in South Africa. 82% of clothing workers are women, which means obviously there's a disproportionate impact if you can create jobs in the clothing sector. It also means there's a disproportionate impact if you lose jobs in the clothing sector, because female-headed households, invariably led by single breadwinners, are impacted. And therefore, this is one of the benefits of supporting the clothing and textile industry. It's common knowledge to everybody that the clothing and textile industry has suffered a major bloodbath over the last decade or so, particularly in the 2000s. It's emerging knowledge, certainly amongst many sectors in South Africa, that there's something of a recovery occurring at the moment. So in the last 3 years, the clothing and textile sectors have witnessed much, much greater or much reduced levels of job losses. In the mid-2000s, it wasn't uncommon to have 16,000 jobs lost in a year, and we are now much lower than that, around 5,000 in some years. It's a continuing trend that we're seeing, and so we believe it signals the stabilization of the clothing and textile industry. It's attributable, we believe, to government's innovative interventions into the sectors. Members will obviously be aware of the Industrial Policy Action Plan, IPAP, and its various industrial policy interventions. And there have also been very innovative interventions by SARS. It's taking a fresh approach towards customs fraud, ways of challenging it or tackling the challenge, and those are having some benefits. Nevertheless, the growth that we're seeing at the moment, the stabilization, the positive news, is precarious. And one of the major reasons why it's precarious, honorable members, is because of customs fraud. Customs fraud is not just limited to the clothing, textile, footwear, and leather sectors. It's experienced more generally in the manufacturing sectors of the country. It can include the automotive industries, the automotive components industries, sweet manufacturing, canned goods, electronics, electrical goods, etc. While the clothing sector itself was maybe the best example historically in recent years, other sectors are raising their voices in fairly passionate ways in the last few years about the impact of customs fraud. Customs fraud, honorable members, occurs in a number of ways. Maybe it's useful to illustrate it with an example. Let's say that goods, a pair of jeans, are loaded onto a ship. They're manufactured either on the coast of China, for example, or maybe is more likely now inland from China, because China is experiencing the absurd situation where workers on the coast are being told that they're more expensive than the workers inland, who are being told they're more expensive than the workers in Bangladesh, who are being told they are more expensive than the workers in Myanmar. China is having that problem itself. But let's say for this example that Chinese workers manufacture jeans, load them onto a ship. The ship freights across the ocean, lands at Durban Harbor. Importers then have the opportunity to declare those goods either legally or illegally. By legally, we mean that they would then pay the 45% duty that's levied on clothing products. Much more likely, they don't. Much more likely, they either under-invoice the products and claim that the value of these goods is much lower and therefore pay a lower duty. Much more likely, they declare these goods as goods which have much lower duties or no duties. Much more likely, they smuggle the goods, which happens very often, and in anecdotal evidence and other research suggests that it happens at inland ports. And much more likely, the goods are rerouted through other Southern African countries and are brought through preferential trade agreements into South Africa at no duty. So what's the impact? Okay. The impact is that fraudulently imported goods are sold into the local markets in a manner that undercuts local prices, local companies, and local jobs. So jobs are lost. Factories close. The machinery of factories is then sold. Deindustrialization takes place. The fiscus doesn't get paid the full value of the duties it is owed. So the South African state is robbed, and we're going to show you later in this presentation just some examples of what this could look like. The investment made in industrial policy interventions, the billions of rands being spent by national government and its agencies on developing industry in the country, are lost as industries begin to close, as factories are lost. And there's the promotion of illegality. So when customs fraud takes place, it encourages the continuation of customs fraud. My comrade Mneba is going to assist. Here's this pair of jeans that arrived. That if you go to Chinatown, these burgeoning Chinatowns across the country, you may discover a pair of jeans selling for 35 rand. Now, it's not possible that goods like this come into South Africa at full value. To reach a price like this, these goods come into South Africa without paying the duty by being smuggled or under-invoiced or on some other measure. Perhaps you go to Chinatown and you decide to buy a lady's blouse. This lady's blouse is worth 20 rand at the Chinatowns, the various other retailers across the country, again, impossibly priced. The only way this can be done is if customs duties are avoided.
That can be a lady's blouse, right? A lady's blouse.
Mm, it's a lady's blouse. Oh, it's a small lady.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I see.
for the men in the room, honorable members, perhaps you want a branded, I'm not sure why you would, but perhaps you want a branded shirt. It's embroidered. It's got printing on it. This top again sells at impossibly low prices. It's just not possible for these goods to come into South Africa legally. The pressure then, honorable members, is that not only are jobs being lost in the local industry, not only is the fiscus being robbed of revenue, but the other consequence is that local retailers or other retailers who would legitimately buy or would buy legitimately dutied products or legitimately locally made products are forced to buy goods on which customs fraud has taken place, because otherwise their goods will be selling for too much and they'll be outcompeted in the market, if that makes sense. So that's why it almost becomes a self-referential cycle. It's useful, honorable members, to take you through some of the data. So the next few slides are really going to get the committee to grips with where this takes place. One of the things, honorable members, that's possible is to go to the SARS data, the values and volumes of imports. Now, there's two ways to do it. So we start at the macro level, at the average declared prices per year. Average obviously doesn't include the lowest. Honorable members, in 2012, the average price, declared price, for women's knitted woolen jackets imported from China, okay, this is the price declared at South African ports of entry, was 1 rand 86. Okay. Honorable members, the average price of women's knitted woolen skirts imported from Bangladesh in 2012 was 2 rand 22. Honorable members, this is not a Chinese problem. This is not a Bangladeshi problem. This is a problem. This slide, honorable members, shows you it happens regularly, whether it be on women's knitted woolen jackets, on cotton skirts, on woven skirts of 3 rand 50 per unit, on woolen skirts of 2 rand 22, or synthetic skirts of 5 rand 29. Honorable members, what does that mean? It means essentially that the 45% duty that's levied on these products is being avoided. So if goods are declared at 8 rand 7 cents, honorable members will see at the bottom of the table there, the men's woven trousers were declared at a unit price of 8 rand and 7 cents. So at 45% duty, that's the equivalent of 3 rand 63 duty per unit. What should these garments probably be imported at? Well, a survey of retailers of similar products across the country shows that they should probably cost between 80 to 120 rand a unit. That's what the declared price should probably be. In other words, the duty that should have been collected should be between 36 rand and 54 rand per unit, which means that between 32 rand and 50 rand worth of duties on each unit, on each of these trousers, is being avoided. And then the table which follows just summarizes that nicely. I'm going to just elaborate very quickly for the honorable members. If we leave the average price and go to actual consignments, it is possible, honorable members, to look at what is actually happening on a day-to-day basis. So, honorable members, what happened on the 16th of February, 2012? Well, it could be any day of the year. The data that SARS provides tells us that a local importer, anonymous, brought a consignment of cotton t-shirts into South Africa from China. There were 25,400 t-shirts in the container. If this was an honest importer, that evidence suggests that that may be few and far between. Unfortunately, SARS don't provide us with that detail. Honourable members, the probable price, the likely price that should have been paid is between 20 and 50 rand per unit. Okay, that's probably what they should have been declared. Then the duty should have been between 9 and 22 rand 50. So what happened on the 16th of February? The importer said that the value of these 25,000 products was 11,000 rand, which means that it was 43 cents per t-shirt, the duty, the cost price, which means that there was 19 cents duty collected per t-shirt. So the state received between 0.8 and 2% of the duties owed to it. Now that's useful to know. What does it mean in a macro picture? Well, firstly, it's useful to know that this is not just limited to the 16th of February or China. It happens in China, Bangladesh, and other places too. This is not limited to one day. It happens 365 days of the year. It's not limited to any one product in clothing or any one product in textiles. It happens in clothing, textiles, footwear, leather, and every other manufactured product, particularly products that we have... that we're manufacturing locally, and obviously that is the concern. It's difficult to measure how much money the state is losing every year, but it is possible to develop some proxies. We do know from these proxies that the problem has been increasing over the last 10 years, and I'm just going to illustrate some of this for you in the next slide. So the slide that we show here, this uses data. This is declared values of imports and exports using the trade data from China and from South Africa. So the blue represents the declared value of imports arriving at South Africa, clothing imports arriving at South Africa from China. The red represents the undeclared value of imports, of exports from China. Okay. Let me show you what happened in 2012. In 2012, the SARS data tells us that we imported 7.7 billion rands worth of clothing from China. The Chinese data tells us that China exported 14.8 billion rands worth of clothing to South Africa. The difference, therefore, is about 7 billion rands worth of clothing came into South Africa unaccounted for. 7 billion rand is the equivalent of about 3 billion rands worth of taxes that should have been collected on clothing alone, from China alone, in 2012 alone. For this example, it's the equivalent of 900,000 people receiving the child support grant for a year, 200,000 people receiving the old age or disability grant for a year, and about 35,000 housing subsidies. So the impact is substantial when it comes to the social development programs of government, the infrastructure programs of government, the education programs of government, the overall economic and social development programs of the state. Honourable members, it's in that context that the customs bills arrive. Now, the customs bills offer the opportunity to weigh up and balance trade facilitation with customs control. They arrived at NEDLAC, and that's precisely the set of discussions that took place there. These were constructive discussions, honourable members. Constituencies arrived with very different opinions. Over time, we found each other, we found commonality, we recognized that there were things in common, and so some very progressive measures found their way into the bills, we believe. Having said that, it's important to know that all parties compromised, and we still believe that it is useful to have harsher penalties, but we are still pleased with what came out. Overall, some of the matters which we're going to reflect on now are the harsher penalties for offenders, people who commit customs fraud, the naming and shaming of people who commit customs fraud and companies, the ability to manage those who trade, who import and are engaged in importation, the ability to stem the flow of illegal imports into the market. We're not going to deal with this point, the disposing of seized goods into the local market, but that is covered in the bills and we're pleased about it. We will talk about the additional capacity that SARS has. Sorry, my presentation has jumped, honourable members. Let me jump back. Sorry, honourable members. And then the last thing is to deal with the limitations on the ports of entry. Perhaps let's jump straight into it. Honourable members, the bills include measures to increase the capacity of SARS and customs officials. That's necessary when you have such large volumes of goods coming into the country and such large volumes of fraud occurring. It's necessary that SARS is able to be more flexible in the way that it designates customs officials, and this is included amongst other places in Section 10 of the Control Bill. Honourable members, the contentious points about clearance at the first point of entry. As we mentioned earlier, the anecdotal and other evidence suggests that when goods arrive at Durban Harbour and are transferred or transported through to City Deep, every opportunity exists to take them out of the container, to remove these goods somewhere else, to fudge the papers if necessary. This is what officials have told us. This is what market intelligence tells us. This is what other research tells us. And therefore, we condone and endorse the fact that there are attempts to curtail customs fraud through designating that clearance must take place at the first point of entry. Honourable members, we believe that it is important to manage the distribution of illegal goods into the market. Obviously, those who bring illegal goods into the markets are not the only ones who touch those goods. In other legislation, if you handle stolen property, stolen goods, you are liable to, you can be held criminally liable for it. Therefore, it's important, and it is in the bills, that there are mechanisms to identify that other parties who handle these goods when they come into the market, those people who provide them through to consumers, those people who fuel the demand for these goods, those people, those companies, those juristic entities can be held liable too. Honourable members, there is substantial justification for more stringent penalties for those who commit customs fraud. You know, just because it's called customs fraud, just because it's white-collar crime, just because it's not as sexy as pointing a finger at government officials in the media, doesn't mean that it doesn't put poor households in poverty, doesn't cause poor households to lose their income, for children not to be fed, to be able to go to school, etc. These are substantial crimes which we believe are being committed. And the customs bills recognize these. They provide for higher fines. So previously it's been much easier for offenders simply just to keep a war chest of money that they, every time they are caught, they just pay some money. It's not very much money, and they pay their way out of trouble. Now there are higher fines in the bills. There's also the ability to graduate from, if you are a repeat offender, to graduate from less severe penalties to much more severe penalties if you show that you have no interest in abiding by the law. There is also the compulsion for laws to consider jail as a sentence. That is new, and we heartily endorse that because we want to see many more people committing this in jail. There are additional punitive measures. So people who commit customs fraud, companies which commit customs fraud, are unjustifiably enriching themselves. They are not just robbing money from the state. They are not just putting people and companies out of business, but they are enriching themselves, and there are mechanisms in the bill now to value the enrichment that takes place and levy penalties against those who commit these offenses on the basis of some of these forms of enrichment that they have. Then there's the ability to hold companies and people liable, personally liable, for committing customs fraud. We believe this is a serious disincentive for customs fraud. And then, of course, there's the ability to name and shame those who commit customs fraud to create reputational damage, which will be a disincentive. Honourable members, we are wrapping up. Four more slides to go. Just a couple of slides to go. Honourable members, we've said it's important to remove the cancer. Honourable Members, if companies and individuals continue to commit customs fraud, there is very little reason why any sane person or sane organisation or sane government would want to allow those people to continue to break the laws of the country. And so the customs bills now include mechanisms to exclude companies from importation who repeatedly break the law. The intention is to promote legitimate trade, to promote a context and environment where legality rather than illegality is the norm. And so we've provided some of the references for you there where you may find these. The conclusion, Honourable Members. There's been very impressive policy formulations, policy work done over the last 4 years to address the developmental challenges of South Africa. Honourable Members from the ruling party may be very pleased to note that Status A has very recently recorded that employment in South Africa is now at its highest level that it's ever been, just over 14 million. This is a recovery and slightly higher than the 2008 figures, which suggests that the current administration has managed to return South Africa in one sitting to the employment levels that we were previously at. That's very good news, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. But there are substantial challenges, and those challenges we believe...
Sorry, a question. Is the presenter referring to the provincial or the national ruling party?
I'm sure SACTU is a national organization, and it operates in a unitary state.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable Members, the work cut out for the South African government from now requires that there's greater cohesion between the industrial measures that we have, the industrial policy measures, the industrial interventions that we have, and the trade interventions. If they have cohesion, it's the keystone in the architecture to building a more functioning, greater job creating economy. It means they must be aligned. It means that since the customs bills deal with customs control and trade matters, they must be aligned to the interests of job creation. In their form that they take at the moment, there may be some amendments to make, but certainly there won't be amendments on any of the matters that we've raised, we're sure. These amendments strike a blow at customs fraud and provide the foundation to begin to have that coherence that we believe will grow jobs even further. Therefore, they have the potential to address the challenges not just in our industry, but in other industries, in the automotive industries, the canned goods, the food industries, the electronics industries, the manufacturing industry in general, set the foundation for a robust industrial base from which South Africa can develop. We have the ability to enhance trade legality and employment creation. And they, I suppose, have the ability and the potential to advance equality, equity, and legality in general. Those are our closing remarks, Honourable Members. As mentioned at the beginning, we support these inclusions in the bill, and we believe we've provided substantial justification for the need for measures such as these to be retained in the bills. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm sure the General Secretary and, Andre Grill, you would probably make your contributions during times of questions and comments.
I would just say I've got nothing further to add. I think it's been very comprehensive.
Thank you. Can we take the next submission? Thank you very much.
Honorable members, let's welcome, if my program is right, Bowman and Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's in fact not Bowman and Fitzgerald, it's SAFIC, the Traffic and Association of Freight Forwarders, but our legal representation is via Bowman and Fitzgerald. Chairperson, honorable members, my name is David Logan, CEO of the South African Association of Freight Forwarders, also known as SAF.
Members are requesting that, you see, judges in court when they speak, like this, into the mic, but very soft. So, just relax, and
I'll do that, Chair, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to make representation to the Standing Committee on Finance on the draft customs bills. Briefly, by way of background, SAF members are responsible for facilitating approximately 70% of the freight handled into and out of South Africa by all our borders, that is seaports, airports and land border posts. In addition to this, most of our members are customs brokers and are responsible for the collection of approximately 170 billion rand in customs duties and import VAT for the fiscus on an annual basis. SAF engaged the services of Bowman Gilfillan to assist us in making representation to this committee. Our main concern being that the bills gazetted on Thursday the 24th of October are not the same versions as of the bills that we have been commenting on previously. Apart from that, we still have issues with the lack of the recognition of inland ports and the severity of the penalties in the bills. We have a number of members of the SAF board with us, namely Mrs. Maria, and Mr. Purimo from the SAFA. As a member, I would now ask Mrs. Sibin of Bowman Gilfillan to take us through the main points of the document submitted to the honourable members. Thank you, Chair.
I think before Bowman Gilfillan speak on our behalf, there's a few other items that I would like to add with regard to SAF and our identity and our function as global facilitators of legal trade, of international legal trade.
Okay.
Sorry to interject.
I just wanted to remind the presenters of the earlier requests that we've made that we should try to make our presentation within a reasonable time, even if we've got this allocated time to yourselves. More so because of written submissions that the committee will take into consideration. So if you talk to submissions, so that we can be able, when we read on our own, be able to be in a better position. I'm not stopping you. I just wanted to remind you that we're going to have three presenters so that we share that time amongst ourselves.
Thank you very much for sharing that information with us. I just wanted that our industry is understood because it's a complex environment that we work within. And just so that as part of our introduction, that people listening to the presentations do have a concept of our business and what it's about and where we fit into the supply chain globally. If I may continue with that, it's very short. One of our concerns with regard to the global trade is that my colleague will discuss the mapping of the most recent legislation that's been presented, and she will speak in more depth about that because we feel it's not been mapped in a way that makes it easy to analyse, and also with regard to the time that's been made available to us. Just to pick up on a couple of items, and I'll be very quick. that were spoken about in the finance bill earlier on. And I know that Parliament facilitates due process, and it's a matter that will come up for us for discussion today, because due process is where we feel we need to focus our activities today. Finally, just to say that we will present a few case studies that will show the impact of misalignment of legislation on trade, and how it's impacted trade. And I would just like to leave it at that and hand over to my colleague, Farusha.
Honourable Chair and members, the South African Association of Freight Forwarders is making this joint submission to the Parliamentary Standing Committee this morning, and is supported in doing so by the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the South African Shippers Council, the Johannesburg Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and the South African Express Parcel Association. The gist of our submission this morning is that SAF and its aligned parties welcome the overdue embracement of the World Customs Organization's revised Kyoto Convention, because we understand that it is the blueprint for customs modernization and trade facilitation. We do not wish to unnecessarily delay South Africa's customs alignment with international best practice. Yet at the same time, there are certain issues that remain unresolved over the years, and we want to use this process to get at least Parliament to understand the practical implications for trade of not abiding by what works for trade, at the same time considering the impact on the country. We come here in a spirit of cooperation, and Honourable Chair, I'd like to re-quote to you your own words this morning, which is that as government, business, trade and civil society, we do need to work together, we need to listen to each other, we need to understand one another before we implement laws. Having said that, the gist of the submission from SAF is that we wish for Parliament to please give us an ear to understand the impact of the legislation on trade. You've heard about the background to the bills, and yes, we were given an opportunity to comment in 2009. A different version was presented, slightly amended in 2011. We were given a month to comment, and yes, we did provide comment. The difficulty we have, sir, is that in August of this year, a different version of the bills was published on the SARS website. It was marked a draft pre-certification version. The difficulty we have is that this was not in markup. It is difficult enough for industry to try and understand this, pay millions of rands to lawyers and consultants to try and understand what this means for trade, and we beg of you to please see it from that context. They were published for information purposes only. We were not told as trade or as lawyers that we must start reading this bill with the intention of commenting. If anything, we were advised by SARS, and we accept that, and we want to be able to comment on this in the parliamentary process. And so here we are in the parliamentary process. We do want to highlight one aspect, which is that the 2011 version of the draft control bill, which controls the operational movement of goods, initially had 897 sections in the 2011 draft. The draft that was gazetted and that we are sitting and talking about today has some 945 sections and at least two additional chapters. Having said that, I would be remiss if I were to state here on record that I know exactly what those additional 47-odd sections or chapters say, because I simply have not had a chance to read it, and that's the honest-to-God truth. What we want, sir, is an opportunity and time from this committee to be able to read, apply our minds, and advise. Our clients, firstly, as lawyers, to the trade, and trade and forwarders to their clients, importers and exporters. That's what the submission boils down to. The draft bills provide significant powers to SARS and dramatically increased obligations to trade. There are significant compliance requirements. We need a chance to read every single word and paragraph to understand what has been changed since the 2011 versions. It is our right to do so. SARC has tried to engage with SARS, and I think both parties can admit that they have reached an impasse on the issue of inland ports. That is a separate issue, and we would like an opportunity to take this forward to even get the committee to understand the implications for trade. Throughout our engagement with SARS over the years, and written comments, meetings, submissions, and discussions, we were guaranteed the right to take this to the Parliament and be given the opportunity to speak to the committee, and that is all that we want and hear. Presumably, the members of the committee itself may not have had sufficient time to understand the import of these bills. We are strongly of the view that if we are given only 1.5 working days to comment on a gazetted bill, and thereafter 2 days to provide oral comment, we are afraid that the bills themselves might be subject to constitutional challenge, simply because we as South Africans, ordinary citizens, have not been given a chance to be heard on the latest draft. That's all that we say. Historically, there have been several examples of how what would happen if draft legislation is then promulgated, and what are the impacts on trade. So at this juncture, I'm going to turn to my colleagues who are going to take us through 2 or 3 examples of what happens if laws are passed, what is the impact on trade, what is the impact to the fiscus, and what is the loss to the economy ultimately.
Thank you. I'm coming in here. I just want to draw your attention to the slide there. I think, as Risha indicated, the draft bill starts across the supply chain. It goes from timelines, reporting, process control, parties, and enforcement. If you go to the next slide there, and I just want to show you that we're all talking about trade facilitation. What is trade facilitation? I think trade facilitation in our environment is a seamless flow of goods. If I can compare it, it's like water in a house pipe. It will flow, but the moment that you stop it, it's going to burst. And I just want to explain to you in 2 case studies what happens if we don't have an alignment in the bill that ultimately goes to the consumer, that ultimately raises our cost of supply chain, which currently is at 12.8%. This morning, I'm sure when you wake up, you saw your toothpaste, your toothbrush, your soap, it all comes from the supply chain. So share with me the implementation of the CO2, the tax environment that came in. It was published on the 30th of August. It was effective the 1st of September. We work with a complex supply chain. There was no notice to the service providers. It cost the industry more than $5 million just to align the data fields, and it was an uncost to the end user in car prices. It was a once-off, and it caused major port congestion. The next slide is even more disturbing. On the 15th of August, no notification to trade, a single tariff heading was changed from one tariff heading to 3 different tariff headings. It came effect the 16th of August. No ITEC permits, no indication of data fields, no notification to trade. It cost the tire industry more than $3.5 million that I'm sure you will pay on the next Michelin or Pirelli that you put on your vehicle. If you go to the 3rd case study, again, it shows the misalignment, and Pat Corbin will touch on the inland ports. We're sitting with about 3 million containers that come from Durban. We have 33 unpacked depots. Currently, SARS unpacked depots and the shipping lines are stopping the containers via risk engine, which we understand, but we need to align the current infrastructure with the shipping lines. It's costing the country, as a hidden cost, 20,000 rand per container for inspection. That cost is not borne or borne by a company, it's unpassed to the end user. And that's why you will see we don't have a control, nothing, and we advocate that we need to look at our logistics cost, which is currently 12.8%, but with the misalignment in tariffs, draft bills, understanding the complexity of the supply chain, the reporting, third-party liability, we really are not looking at the total picture and we don't engage all the suppliers in the supply chain.
Thank you, Yunita. I think the gist of it is that our economy is not in a position to handle this kind of damage to trade. Parliament must note that more than 60% of all trade is generated by SMMEs. This non-alignment of the proposed law and how trade functions will be detrimental to SMMEs in particular. I want to touch very briefly on the inland ports issue. As I've said previously, SAF and SARS have reached this impasse. They haven't been able to agree on how this should read going forward, and there is severe impact to trade as has been highlighted and will continue to be highlighted by Pat Corbin going forward. Ultimately, in simple English, the 2011 version of the control bill was worded such that the goods must be cleared at the first port of entry, in other words, Durban, for example. So clearance at the first port of entry, as envisaged in the draft control bill, will require a declaration of the value of the goods, the duties and taxes that are to be paid, in addition, the origin of the goods and a description of the goods as per the harmonized system. The SARS view is that this HS code will indicate whether the goods will pose a fiscal or economic risk, safety and security, etc. What this means in practical terms for trade is that historical inland ports such as City Deep in Johannesburg, to which containerized cargo could move directly upon arrival under cover of a manifest, would no longer be designated places of entry or exit for customs purposes. SARS's stance is that this is necessary to ensure greater control over supply chain movement and risk assessment. Trade disagrees, as our view is quite simply that anyone could misdeclare, anyone could turn around and underdeclare still, declare the wrong tariff heading, and we don't see the benefit to the economy of getting rid of or not acknowledging that a place such as City Deep is an inland port. Yes, it will still be a terminal, but the fact that it will no longer be an inland port is of great concern for trade. I'm not going to labor the issue. Pat Corbin will take you through the practicalities and the impact on international trade on this particular issue. Ultimately, South Africa will be running the risk of losing its competitiveness as a place of entry of choice for Southern Africa. It will lose its status as a transit corridor, and it's foreseen that trade will be lost to other corridors into Southern Africa, as I have just mentioned. The extension of insurance and the cost of insurance along the supply chain, the consequent impact on marine insurers, the interruption of warehouse-to-warehouse movement will cost the economy billions of rands. The South African economy cannot absorb the effects of this kind of fiscal tsunami. We implore you to please consider this seriously from the point of view of trade. Unless trade is given an adequate opportunity to review, comment, and have its say on how this will impact on supply chain movement, it's foreseen that the negative effects on supply chain functionality will impact greatly on imports, exports, and is likely to lead to an even greater imbalance in this country's already difficult and strained trade deficit. At this juncture, I wish to turn to the Parliament's role in this legislative process and why we are here today. 19 years into our democracy, let us not forget about the right to be heard. It's a basic human right. The Constitution imposes this duty on the National Assembly to facilitate public involvement before laws are passed. This duty stems from Section 1 of the Constitution, which provides for a system of democratic government that is accountable, responsive, and open, and that is why we are here today. If a bill is published for comment, and the Assembly Committee to which this bill is presented, this committee must arrange its business in such a manner that interested persons and institutions have an opportunity to comment. And this, sir, is what I'm quoting to you from your own National Assembly rules. If a bill has not been published for comment and the committee to which the bill is referred considers public comment on the bill necessary It may, by way of invitations, press statements, advertisements, or in any other manner, invite the public to comment. So this committee has an enormous amount of power. You have the discretion over the appropriate method to facilitate public involvement in this legislative process. The manner of public participation that will be undertaken, the time frames and the people to be consulted are all left to your discretion. And you are responsible for what happens, given the fact that we have already touched on the implications for trade if there isn't proper consultation. And our bugbear is simply this. The current draft that was gazetted last week Thursday afternoon is what we are talking about today. We were given all of Friday and half of Monday to provide written comments. I myself have not had enough chance to read every word of the version that was gazetted, and that is the crux of our submission today. We need more time. That's simply it. We need more time to read. We need more time to consult. We need more time to advise, apply our minds, and we need more time to actually educate one another and advise Parliament on how this works and how it shouldn't work. I suppose the question that you would pose to us is, if we haven't been able to resolve certain issues over the past 4 years, what makes us think that we could resolve this in 60 days or 30 days? And I will come to that at the end of this submission. Ultimately, as you know, this parliamentary process is not safe from judicial review. It can be overturned by the courts. And I simply want to point this out because our courts have said in the Doctors for Life judgment, which you probably are aware of, about why it's important for the public participation process to be reasonable. And what is reasonableness? It's an objective standard which is sensitive to the facts and circumstances of each case. The question that arises in public participation is whether taking all facts into account, the legislative process met the standards of reasonableness. In the Doctors for Life judgment, a 2006 Constitutional Court judgment, the court stated very clearly that the constitutional provisions provide a right and impose a duty to ensure public participation in the lawmaking process. The court held that the constitutional duty has two components. The first, this committee has the duty to provide meaningful opportunities for public participation. The second is to take measures to ensure that people have the ability to take advantage of the opportunities provided. In facilitating public involvement, Parliament must do what is reasonable in all the circumstances. The method and degree of public participation that's reasonable will depend on a number of factors, such as the nature and content of the legislation. We've said it's wide-ranging, it's going to replace the existing act. The importance and urgency of it, the intensity of the impact of the legislation, the degree of public interest, practical considerations, time constraints, and resources. Other factors that the Constitutional Court have highlighted is that the purpose of public comment procedure is to enable Parliament to inform itself of the views of the people. Parliament must keep an open mind and must consider the views expressed by members of the public. I want to touch on the issue of urgency and this Parliament's timetable. The court in the Doctors for Life case has said and considered the aspect of urgency with which the legislature undertook the public comment process, and it considered this deeply to consider and advise on whether or not the legislature acted reasonably. In this case, the court made it very clear. Although time is a relevant consideration, the temptation to cut down on public involvement must be resisted. Problems encountered in speeding up a sluggish timetable do not ordinarily constitute a basis for inferring that inroads into the appropriate degree of public involvement are reasonable. The timetable must be subordinated to the rights guaranteed in the Constitution. In our view, if no further attempts are made at facilitating public participation beyond today, the legislature runs the risk of having acted unreasonably in facilitating public participation in the legislative process. I don't want to labor this point anymore.
Sorry, let me just find out. Is there contention in your presentation that you have not studied or you have not had the opportunity to study the bill?
and therefore you're talking more about the process and what Parliament should do.
Ultimately, trade wants more time because we want to be able to read every word of the version that was published on Thursday last week. It's now only Wednesday. We need more time, and we want you to give us more time. And in doing so, and I will touch on what we think can happen that hasn't happened before, because there has, as I said, there's this impasse with respect to the Inland Ports. We can't seem to agree.
The point I wanted to raise with you is that I think Parliament would know exactly what it should do in terms of the processes and to determine, the government to determine its own process. So I don't think it is going to be of much assistance to dwell much on the process for Parliament.
As I've said, I'm done with that aspect and I don't want to labor it. What I want to talk about now shortly is the future, because as I've said, we need more time to make a meaningful contribution. And we think that if you ask us what will change if you give us 30 or 60 more days, our answer to that is quite simply, we will have studied the legislation, we will provide more detailed comment. But over and above that, we would like to approach SARS and consider the fact of how we could, I don't know, come to some conclusion on an independent mediator that could listen to both sides and at least assist the parliamentary process in coming to a decision on the inland ports issue, for example. Because trade has its concerns, SARS has its concerns, and there's no middle ground. The way we see it, it's a one-way, my-way or the highway approach, which is not going to work for trade. And Mr. Pat Corbin will touch on that in his presentation to follow. So ultimately what we want is not only further engagement and opportunity, but we want to be able to work with SARS and hopefully set up some kind of tribunal to understand and listen to both parties' submissions before a final word on the inland ports, for example, is put forward. And that is our submission in a nutshell.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have received and we hear what you are saying. As part of our parliamentary process, we'll consider your submission in terms of how we determine our own program as parliamentary committee. But thanks for the presentation.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Can you take the last presentation? South Africa, what is this? Sorry? The chamber. Thank you, Chair. I've abdicated my responsibility to you. Tell us who you are.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Corbin. Whilst I am the Director of the International Chamber of Commerce, I'm also the past President of the Johannesburg Chamber of Commerce. If we can just knock through it to the... Can we go through the next one? How will you move on? Just the menu, the agenda, we're just going to have a look at a brief introduction. The legislation that we're talking about, the inland port benefit to the coastal ports themselves, the benefit to the inland traders, the World Customs Organization perspective through Kyoto, and some recommendations that we have to make, and I'll do it as quickly as I can. Since 1977, the Johannesburg Chamber has been very intimately involved with City Deep as probably the fifth largest inland port in the world. And in fact, well before that, while City Deep was being put together, and it started in July 1977. And it was in line with the universal objectives, which we all agree with, to promote multimodal transport. And at the time, the shipping lines introduced a marvellous innovation, which was a multimodal bill of lading, which meant that international traders could operate from inland ports to inland ports. One could ship then from Johannesburg to Frankfurt or to Mexico City or to wherever on the ship's manifest, one document, very simple. We've also been understanding the benefits of having these ports, particularly with landlocked countries, which are being pushed internationally through all the aid agencies. I mentioned here UNCTAD, but all in Africa particularly, we've got a very big function now on logistics, and that is including the creation of inland ports, particularly through landlocked countries, the African Development Bank on board, the United States aid trade hub in Botswana is on board, the United Nations functions. It's very much focused on making trade simple and assisting developing countries. The World Bank report is in this direction, Pan-African Commission. We've got the African Union now in this last month forming a commission to get the logistics moving into Africa so we can do more trade. So that's where we're coming from. The next issue that we're looking at now is the... the order that came through, we've just reorganized it a bit so it's more focused. We're looking at what the debate which has been going on in NEDLAC, as has been said this morning, since 2009. And the issue that we discussed, which were raised by customs, was the initial one which caused some eyebrows to raise, was that City Deep will be a container terminal per definition. And the response from customs was, well, it never was an inland port. And we strongly said, well, hold on, it's always been an inland port since 1977. So this is one of the areas where we were not on the same page. And internationally, there's quite a bit of confusion with what is an inland port by definition. And we agree with customs that an inland terminal is not an inland port. But any inland facility that has the status by customs of an international gateway is an inland port, and it means that international trade can take place to and from that particular point. And when the customs then said that no inland movement before customs declaration, obviously that was another area of some serious concern, and they went on to say that the manifest information would no longer be considered adequate for risk assessment. Internationally, that is the practice that is growing, that inland ports are being increased tremendously. There's 200 in Europe at the moment, and that the goods are moving from the coastal port to the inland destinations on the manifest. The comments that came from customs, which were again causing us quite some concern, was no provision, as I say, exists there. Well, we say it does, because City Deep has functioned as an inland port since 77, so we don't know how you're playing with definitions. If you're saying it's a terminal, and we're saying, well, whatever you like to call it, it functions as an inland gateway, inland port. And then the point that we do agree with customs on is that not the intention to terminate the manifest or clog up ports. Well, what customs are proposing unintentionally will have that effect, and this is the discussion that we're having with them at the moment, and I hope it will be ongoing. And we disagree with them when they say that the contract of carriage has got nothing to do with the sales contract, because seriously, the contract of carriage comes from the sales contract, and people do not contract, and carriers do not contract beyond their ability to perform, and no shipping line is going to contract to deliver past the customs post, and no exporter is going to export past the customs post and have a suspensive condition. And to suggest that the legislation is not going to impact on exports is just not true, because you will not be able to internationally export from City Deep anymore as an inland port. You will not be able to get a multimodal document. Your exports and imports will be conducted from the coast. So the concept of carriage and coastal clearance requirements not connected, well, that is just not so. I'm sorry about this. When we sent it through, we now look at this benefits to coastal ports. We're on track now, actually, with the thought of the customs intervention here. the points that we're making here, and you can all read them, is that these are tremendous benefits to the coastal ports. As you all know, you read in the media, we have tremendous congestion in the Port of Durban at the moment, and you must take cognizance of the fact that we have a trade downturn and that we are seeing a tremendous amount of cargo being diverted from our ports. We're losing our hub status, we're losing our gateway status because of the problems of operating through the South African logistics system. Zimbabwe and Zambia particularly are focusing more on Maputo and Walvis Bay, and even Dar es Salaam now is moving a lot of cargo in and out of Zambia that used to come through South Africa. A benefit to removing congestion from the coastal ports, of course, is that it does enhance, and having the inland ports does enhance the gateway status of a port, because ports are more increasingly competing, particularly with the largest vessels at the moment. They are targeting the ports that have got the best interland arrangements. The major issue in the port, of course, is when there's a through manifest, the goods are discharged for rail, onward rail connection, they move by rail. If there's no possibility of manifesting inland, then they go into a general stack, and you have this tremendous problem in shifting the boxes around to find the box, even when it eventually goes by rail. And it takes away the movement of a seamless movement inland. And this is another word that we're not in harmony with customs on. What is the definition of seamless? And seamless means that the box can hit the deck in Durban and be on the train within hours and out of the port, reducing the congestion. That's the concept. Any intervention means that the ship's manifest will cease at the port, but we'll come back to that. And of course, once you can export, once you can consign internationally to an inland destination, inland port, then you have a very attractive proposition for the railways. And I'll give you evidence of that just now. So the coastal ports have a tremendous benefit to be gained by anything that removes their congestion and their land movements. As you can see, rail movement out of the port has a very favourable impact on the port city environs. You've seen all the problems that we have with the land movements in and out of the Durban port at the moment. And it has, of course, a marked impact on road traffic in the portal area. Coastal area. And of course, an efficient port has a direct impact on ocean freight rates. And we are picking up already that the ocean freight rates to South Africa are definitely tweaked higher because of the inefficiency of our port. So when I say the inefficiency, perhaps I'm being unkind, because the capacity of the port is out of sync with the growth in the trade. And I think that's common. Course. You can imagine when Christmas comes and our industry slows down. With the inland port situation in Johannesburg, we have thousands of containers undeliverable sitting in Johannesburg because the factories have closed, they can't accept delivery. If this situation is reversed, those boxes will be sitting in the port of Durban or in the environs of Durban. They'll all be moving out of the port by road. And of course, the situation will be gridlocked. It's quite impossible. It's quite interesting to mention, we've been talking about security risks of moving goods inland. Well, customs also are aware of an UNCTAD study which has been held into corruption in the ports of Durban and Maputo, comparing the two ports. And we contend, without fear of contradiction, that a box landing in Durban and being put onto rail and moved into city deep is much safer, more secure than sitting around for a few days in the port area, being moved out of the port area into a depot, which will happen. And the benefits to the traders now, if we look at the benefits of an international gateway status, there are so many that I don't want to take up your time going through them, but they're so obvious from an economic activity point of view, an employment point of view. And conversely, of course, taking away that status has a tremendously negative effect. And I'm surprised unions haven't engaged with the staff at City Deep, because there will be thousands and thousands of people out of work if that status is removed. The extended time for clearance and line release, of course, is a tremendous benefit of having the goods moving seamlessly through the port without any intervention. The import has got more time to get its act together. And where customs and the trade are not on the same wavelength is that it's not customs that release the cargo. It's the shipping line that release the cargo. And the customs clearance is a vital requirement before the shipping line can release the cargo. So the minute that you have an intervention and you require that the action should take place at the port, then the shipping line's manifest will terminate there, and it will only, the shipping line will only release, not after customs clearance has taken place, but after bills of lading have been produced. So there's going to be tremendous negatives there. And the rail inland movements, which everybody knows are environmentally and financially attractive, will definitely be will be impacted, and I'll show you just how in a minute. And the opportunity for promoting containerized exports is vast when you've got an inland port. We've been very successful in Johannesburg in enticing cargo and iron ore, copper ingots and so on from Zambia, from the Congo, to actually be containerized in Johannesburg. It's created a massive industry and it's created a balance. We're actually filling up the empty containers and sending them back instead of empty, sending them back with goods which otherwise would be sent down by road to the port. And of course, from Transnet Freight Rail's point of view, they get the traffic both ways. They bring the containers up with the goods and they're not taking the train back empty or the containers back empty. So the opportunity to promote those exports SACD, for example, in Johannesburg, have just spent many, many millions on producing a specialised facility to enhance the containerisation of their cargo. If we just continue to look at the benefits to the trader, you can see here that door-to-door multimodal transport is a massive benefit. You have only one party to talk to about your box from the time it leaves the supplier to the time it gets to your area, your report. You talk to the line, they would tell you at any time of the day where or not your box is and how it's doing, when you can expect it. The minute you terminate at the coast, you've finished. Your export is out. You now have got to reconsign. You've got to appoint an agent and so on and so forth. It is so cumbersome, which is totally against what we're aiming for. You see? And of course, internationally working with the WCO, they are promoting the customs to be in close proximity to the trader. They want the customs to be on the same area, so when your box gets examined, you're there, you don't have to have an agent 600 kilometres away doing the job for you. And you heard this morning, every box that gets stopped for examination is costing a good 15,000 rands. And of course it's interrupting the supply chain, so all this just-in-time importing goes for a loop. We just had a chat this last week, 20,000 for one box of granules for making plastic, whatever. It was stopped by the border police, another problem which we won't address now. But of course, the major advantage that has been proved internationally is when you've got inland ports, and we want to promote more of them, not take them away, is that you encourage local economic activity, investment and employment. And this is a fact that is in dispute. And, of course, as I mentioned, you cut out the need for an importer to actually have a coastal agent. So I'm talking against my colleagues now, but perhaps if I was staff, I'd be saying, I think it's a good idea, everybody will need a coastal agent at the coast. But we are saying that from the trade board, representing the users, as the Chamber of Commerce does, that we do not believe that it's necessary, you see. I'd just like to share with you a presentation that we had at the International Chamber of Commerce recently from the Maersk Line. And Maersk Line are promoting actively their inland port structure. Now, the interesting thing about this slide is that when we talk about the shipping line multimodal document, we talk about the carrier, the line arranging the inland transport. That's carrier haulage. Now, when the manifest terminates at the coast, then the trader has to arrange the transport to and from the coastal port. So then you have what we call merchant haulage. Now, you see, when there is no inland port, and you can see that in most instances there, the amount of goods moving by rail was 12%. When they put in a proper rail dedicated line with right equipment, and I might add, run by Maersk Line itself, I think it was from Frankfurt to Hamburg, Frankfurt or wherever, but that line, the rail, moved from 12% to 60%. Now, the qualifying comment here is that we are interacting with Transnet Freight Rail. We want to see more goods on the rail. All of us do. And Shamrock does. Everybody does. Even the road haulers do. We all want to achieve the same objective. And we interact very closely with Freight Rail, with Vafreng Varma. And I've said to him this last month, what is your plan? What's your objective to get your rail up? Which at the moment, I might tell you, is 15.8% of 1.9 million containers last year, and only 762 were moved in and out of the port by rail. What does that tell you? It sadly tells you, nothing to do with this scenario, but it sadly tells you that Transnet Freight Rail and the Transnet have totally neglected the provision of infrastructure for the growth in containers, which has been a good 10% on average for many years, and the investment has not even been 2%. So if you want to know why goods are moving by road, talk to Transnet. And we all want to achieve this. And the environment says to me, look, I said to him, what's your plan? He said, we're spending $14.8 billion on new equipment to move goods in there. We are spending $4 billion or $3 billion on a new container terminal at City Deep. And our objective is to get our goods up to what we're talking about here. And in the foreseeable future, we hope to even get up to 30%. So I'm saying, well, we from organised business would support you in getting up to 60%, but you must provide a reliable service. Because what is happening, even boxes that are consigned to City Deep, when they get to Durban, people are actually changing it. They're changing the manifest to say, take the box off here, I don't want to lose it in the rail system internationally. And this is what the message is going out internationally. And I'm only harping on this because this is having a direct impact on the cost of our logistics, which, as you know, are very, very high. And incidentally, on the export side, because the status of CD customs intention is to remove it, you will not be able to have an international transport document issued in City Deep. The exporter will be totally responsible for taking his box down to Durban and putting it on the ship in Durban. All that unknown situation that happens when you rail down to Durban, at the moment the carrier accepts the risk. That carrier is out of the loop, and the exporter will have to get the box down there, and you can't do that by rail. So you will now see that more exports will go down by rail, because the exporter, if he gets that box into the terminal, and he does it into the port and it doesn't connect with the ship, he is going to get a heck of a bill. And so he can't accept the risk which at the present moment is carried, accepted by the shipping line. So that's a big problem we've got there. So for customs to say it's not going to impact on export is totally not correct. If we can just move on here to our... just on the Kyoto perspective... we interact with the World Customs Organization, and we were with them 2 weeks ago, and I want to tell you that the World Customs Organization, they have a gentleman there who is one of the senior directors of facilitation and compliance, and he's been to North Africa, he's been to the Caribbean, and what's his mission? Promoting inland ports. And he was quite surprised to learn of the uphill we were having in South Africa on this particular subject, and what he is saying to us, and we are not to further continue with our presentation to him, but he was saying that listening to our problems and the view of customs relative to the risk in the moving the goods inland and so on, he was saying that we have got a post importation focus on compliance at the moment, which we find is very effective. We have asked that they clarify, on the Kyoto perspective, there's a recommendation here that customs authorities do promote the inland, not just inland ports in the country, but they promote the movement through their territories to the hinterland, to the landlocked country. So we've said it would help us a lot if there was a more clarity in the Kyoto Convention, which is the guidelines for international customs. 91 international countries have signed up to Kyoto internationally, and we want them to make it more clearer and more forcefully in line with the international practice there. If we can just go on here to the keep going right to the end. I'm just looking at my We put this thing together reasonably quickly here because we wanted to. Just on the recommendations there. As I say, we've asked for the strengthening there. We want to promote rail. Now, I say public-private partnership. You know, even in India, you've got five private rail operators on the national railway network. trade rather than the transit port authorities to move these boxes and attract the business back to rail. And we want the education at WCO level. They have a program on at the moment. They have somebody from Mozambique, they have somebody from Malawi on a training program for customs officers. And we're saying that we recognize that there's a need with the customs coming from where we come from to be more in tune with how the international trading cycle works so that we don't talk past each other. And the international aid for transport, I must tell you, is moving towards the areas where the countries, coastal countries, are committed to providing providing infrastructure and facilitation for the inland countries and the landlocked countries. And I think what I'd like to close off by saying is we wish to really try and reach a conclusion with the customs on this understanding of how a manifest works, because we are totally clear on the fact that shipping lines only operate between ports, and the belief of customs have that a manifest can still be issued to a city deep if it's not an inland port is just not so. And I can't believe that in the discussions that we have that we can't make progress in this direction, because I sincerely believe that, and I support customs' desire not to clog up the ports, not to interfere, and from day one customs have never, in our estimation, fully understood the significance of removing the status of city deep as from an inland port to a terminal. And that's what we would like to propose here, that we get this situation got such serious implications for the economy, for road movements, for everything, so vast that we really like to continue discussions with customs and the interaction that we have had. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, can I make a proposal on how we handle these submissions? I know we've run far behind our schedule. We're supposed to be breaking for lunch until 2 o'clock as a committee in terms of our schedule. You know. What I was going to suggest that we take the next 20 minutes, entertain the submissions, and break for lunch, and come back at 2. That's the sacrifice we have to make on our part, honourable members. Any comments on the submissions? Honourable Luyange, Matami.
Thank you, sir. Let me first appreciate the elaborate and precise presentations by the three presenters, which I believe, sir, when I will start with the very last one, the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the notion that says, as a recommendation, I like the part of recommending, not just pointing fingers without putting an alternative. The one that says, let there be a public-private partnership. It's a mouthful, Chief, which I would offer in that the South African National Civic Organization to be part of that, because it's public-private partnership, and then one needs to champion that. You can start that process, government can do, and also the community component can do that. I really appreciate that. And then when you go to SATU, there are shocking revelations made there, which we need to appreciate, meaning that we need to do a lot in order to ensure that we prevent ourselves from being used. So these revelations maybe are as a result of a notion of the lack of consultation between SARS and the organizations, which I believe, not necessarily for the purposes of this bill, there should be such interactions in execution of one's duty. I would suggest that taking into consideration what has been said here, it really gives us an understanding as to what is taking place around us, and some of these things we experience, look how our economy is being jeopardized by these kind of acts, which are really unbearable. Thank you, sir.
Can I also just invite staff to leadership or present us back here so that if there are questions you need to respond from here. Honorable Harris, Honorable Goranov, before Honorable Madani, followed by Honorable Harris and Goranov and Honorable Ross, in that order. I hope you'll remember.
Thank you, Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair.
You know what?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would like to take this opportunity and thank the two presenters that gave some contributions and some very important information to us, which is the SATU and the CCI and the three. Yeah. Although, Chair, I do have the questions, but I'll try to limit them because of the time. So I will try to get some short clarity from the CCI and the SATU. SATU, I understand your concerns about the customs capacity, which is very important, especially with the congestion that you see at our Durban ports. However, though, I would like to understand, we are aware of the scan machine, which is there, which is operating, right? Now, I would like to even get even more of the information. It might not be today, but you may submit it to National Treasury. As to how then do we try and stop, one, that fraudulent we talk about, which is critical, two, miscalculations of what is within the container itself, and making sure that irrespective that we cannot assess, you know, check each and every container and see what is inside, what measures can we do so as to ensure that that failure to collect what we're supposed to collect as SARS is being stopped. You might not answer today, but it's critical that the National Treasury, before we pass this bill, we have got the information, we've got that understanding, so as to try and bridge the gap. Because we put the machine there, the scan, and seemingly even with the scan, we're not coping because of the overload of the vessels that stand at one time, and they need to be empty, they need to be. And this is the capacity I think we are talking about, that the customs needs to ensure that it has got the proper capacity, well-trained, knowing what to do, moving vessels very fast, capturing being happened, and a proper percentage is being used, so that we stop that 45% and the 20 rand and the 50 rands. To the CII, sir, thank you very much. I don't have anything for you, it was quite clear, but thank you very much for your interaction with the National Treasury, because throughout your presentation, we could see you have been interacting with the National Treasury and giving some with the SARS. I'm so sorry, with the SARS, Chair, and you've been giving them the advices. But however, Chair, I'm a bit not clear. Your proposal that the inland ports, we need to make sure that, like the city deep, if I heard you very well, we need to, according to you, we need to have more of those, or we need to utilize it as having some custom services within the inland port. Now, my concern is, who is the port of entry then? Because if we miss the port of entry, we might lose a lot of money. Because when the goods, they move from Durban to Joburg, there's a movement that is happening there. So, if you can just clarify that for me, that, okay, fine, we need to have customs at City Deep, services at City Deep. But who is the port of entry? Who is the port of entry?
Yeah.
Where does the custom services take place? Thank you, Chair.
Good night.
No, just hold the questions.
Yeah.
No, don't respond now.
No.
Each one of you will know the questions that are directed to them. And then at the end of all taking these questions, then you'll respond. The next, is that your team?
Thanks, Chair.
Okay.
I think there's been some very valid concerns raised around the urgency issue in the parliamentary process. I gather this has been going informally since 2007, and I guess formally since 2009. So certainly with this committee dealing with a huge number of bills in the next week and a half, it does seem a bit strange to have to deal with enormously complex and long bills for the first time today. I certainly, as an individual member of this committee, feel rather overwhelmed, and I'm sure many of my colleagues do too. Well, okay, I'm glad you're on top of it, Honourable Flamini.
Can we have order, Honourable Members?
We have a 300-page bill before us and then two others. I believe they've got 900 and 200 sections in each of them. But, Chair, we've had presentations and there hasn't been a single proposal in terms of an actual amendment to the text, which is certainly unprecedented in my experience in Parliament. And I think shows that indeed 3 days from the publication of the bill until now, 3 working days, is not sufficient for presenters to be able to get their heads around rather complex pieces of legislation. Because if we go ahead now with these submissions, we actually don't have any proposals for changes, technical proposals. And I'm certainly not comfortable proceeding like that in this committee. So I think it's entirely reasonable to accept the request to delay until next year. That's my position. Chair, on the matter of the city deep and inland port, I've been trying to look at the definitions to see if it comes down to a definitional change. If someone could direct me to a definition of inland port or of container terminal or specifically in the definition sections where there might be a quick and easy fix for the treatment of city deep. Because I understand that whilst SARS is pushing ahead with this bill, and clearly there are reasons why we need this bill, we need to modernise customs, we need to crack down on illegal imports, as Saktu pointed out. This committee all agrees with that. But my understanding is that the Transnet and Johannesburg City are busy investing in City Deep. They're currently expanding it. I believe there's R1 billion expansion of City Deep. So if that's proceeding, if that's true, that's what I've heard, I would like that to be verified. But if that's true, then are we not totally out of step with Transnet and with the City of Johannesburg in proceeding with this bill that will essentially remove City Deep status even as they're investing R1 billion into it? On track to, for the NEDLAC process, can you confirm if NEDLAC published a report on these bills? And, the whole committee accepts the presentation you made. I think it is alarming that this criminal activity is happening. But is it not an enforcement matter rather than a legislative matter? Can we not solve it broadly by enhancing SARS's ability to enforce the existing laws rather than introducing a whole set of new laws? And in your presentation, I didn't see anything that you wanted to change in the bills. Are you happy with all of the detail in all of these bills? The SAAFF, if you got more time and if these bills were aligned with the WCO and WTO processes, and if we resolve the issue around the inland ports of City Deep, would you be happy with the bills? Do your concerns go further than those three issues? I know you're concerned about not being able to reach agreement with SARS, but I can put your mind at ease here. The legislators in this process are us. We write the laws. You must engage with SARS, and I'm glad that you have, and that process must be conducted, but at the end of the day, this committee writes the laws of the country. So we need to be happy, actually, in the end of the day. And then lastly, Chair, to the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, I need a brief briefing on the difference between a manifest and a declaration, and why that's such an important issue in this case. And I accept, I think, as you said, everybody wants to get more onto rail than is currently on road. But if City Deep isn't inland ports currently, that's the status quo. We have a problem getting incentivizing more freight onto rail. What, in your opinion, needs to change in the bill to help us get further along the road? And then related to that, your recommendations on the last page, they all seem reasonable to me. But which of them can be solved in this bill? And if there are any that can be solved in this bill, it would be useful to get formulations of you, from you of how the bill should read to try and achieve those recommendations, which I think all sound entirely reasonable.
Chairperson, I think I'm fairly covered but with regard to what Honourable Harris has said. I just want to ask the first presenters, the union. Say, for instance, SARS were fully equipped to do a proper policing job. Would you have been here today? I know legislation is a deterrent, but if it's not policed, it's not working. So what would you like to see? Better policing or this bill? Or both? Obviously both. And then also just to all the presenters except for SARF, I take your point. I think it is unfair to publish a version of the bill and then expect you to come in front of us within 4 or 5 days. But to the other presenters, because clearly they will come up, and maybe, can I just ask, will you come up with proposals for amendments? Do you foresee that? But to the other two presenters, don't you want any amendments to this bill? Are you happy with it as it stands? Especially the unions. Are you happy as it stands? No amendments.
For Ross and Mount Palmer.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, for me there's two issues that we need to look into. The first one is the customs fraud. And I think a long way, many of the issues, there's a nice trend in terms of addressing the customs fraud. The first presenter also said, you know, in terms of industrial and revenue interventions, there was progress made in terms of this and a resultant in less jobs being lost. But certainly we cannot afford any more job loss. So that's important to note that we need to look into how can we stop the customs fraud, and that's perhaps a question to Mr. Lowe once again in terms of enhanced efforts to stop the customs fraud. The second issue, of course, for me is not jeopardizing trade and not undoing what we have. And we've seen a very good presentation in terms of a gateway, in terms of international trade, and we simply can't afford also, on the other side of the coin, to see our trade deficit being jeopardized in any way. So it's two issues that we need to resolve. We need to find a balance in terms of this. Mr. Lowe can perhaps give us an indication as to the progress in terms of legislation and what is expected, and I think my colleagues discovered that. To have specific recommendations that we find the balance in improving customs fraud prevention, and secondly to see that we preserve our job creation goals and also that we preserve our trade. And also for Johannesburg in that area, it might have a devastating blow in terms of economic activity and job losses also. It was good presentations. I think we have the bigger whole presented to us today. It's important issues, and if we need to spend more time before we take final decisions, I will support them. Thank you.
Maybe just your input, Honourable Gong. Just to inform the Honourable Members that we have got a new member of our committee from the IFP, Honourable Gong here. As you are aware, that Honourable Grosini has not been well for quite some time, so she is stepping in as a member of the Finance Committee, for in case you ask who is she. So, and you are welcome. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the introduction. I would like to get on to the input. I think the first input which I would like to just upload is actually the input, I think it's from the union, where they were addressing certain slides, like the slide on the lost revenue, you know, where you were comparing the old age grants and the child support grants, as well as removing the cancer. Those were quite critical to me. I must state that a lot of the information which was given by yourself is actually food for thought. May I then move over to the second input? That's the input, Chairperson, from Bowman and Gilfillan. A lot was said from the input, but Chairperson, there's something which I've noticed with this input. It's what is between the lines. It's what has not been said, although it's been said in a very subtle manner. For instance, from the input that you got from yourself, how much time do you need? How much more time do you need? Because this committee has got to think along those lines to give you input. Because the impression which I got was that your company is even prepared to take this matter further immediately you move out of that door. So we need to talk about that so that we get an understanding of that. It's what you did not say which actually is busy needling me than what you said. Thank you very much.
The responses will be in the order of your presentations. The first presenters were Sagtu, followed by Gorman Gilfillan and the Chamber. Let me say, SARS will not give you the opportunity to respond today. You are coming next week as part of your report, therefore, all the submissions that we had to the committee. Okay. Thanks, Honorable Ngomo, for your question. Over to you, two. So your thing is not working.
My thing is working, Chair. just on a lighter note. Chair, I will just apologize if we've missed the names, but we'll be very brief and concise and to the point in the sets of questions. On the first set of questions, ma'am, we will welcome the opportunity to do supplementary concrete submissions. But we have, at a very practical level, been working very closely at operational level with SARS to try to iron out some of the more practical issues that you're raising. Let me give two examples. The one is on the miscalculation in the containers, as you call it, which we interpret you're referring to under-invoicing of goods. We have made concrete proposals there. For example, better policing and better monitoring of the reference pricing system. On the issue relating to, we understand the practical problem that you can't inspect every container. We have made practical recommendations. For example, 100% surprise inspections, and in our initial discussions it was at the number of ports of entries and not at one dedicated port of entries. But of course this changes the situation now. That's just by illustration, but we will assist by providing additional update there. On the second set of questions, which I think it came from Member Harris, I think, yes, there was a very intensive NEDLAC process. We were very involved in it, and there was a formal NEDLAC report that was published. Secondly, would we like to see enforcement rather than legislation? Let me put it this way. We are very supportive and very complimentary of the work that SARS has done, in particular since the inauguration of the new administration in 2009. The amount of work that they've done, for example, on seizures has been unprecedented. We've got virtually no criticism for the work and the willingness to buckle down to execute the work in that regard. But we do understand that they need better teeth through legislation to assist with the tightening and the speeding up and the better implementation of enforcement. That also answers part of the third question, which I think, if the name is Kornoff, I think it has come from you. So I will skip that. Then I'll deal with the two dual questions, which is, are we happy as it stands at the moment? Look, there are many things that we can try to include. But in the NEDLAC processes, we respect that there's been many compromises from, I think, all three sides. And we don't want to jeopardize that process. We understand it. We respect that. And for us here, it's not a situation of holding out for a maximum position or after we've agreed in the NEDLAC process, the tripartite processes, now to take another step and to try to smuggle, you know, in, to use a word which might be appropriate here, something that we have agreed to drop in the NEDLAC processes. Thank you for those comments. Chair, that is what we have to say, unless Simon is or whoever has got something else to add.
Honourable Chairperson, thank you. You know, on the matter of the legislation, just to go back to that, our interest, there may be points too that our SARS beliefs would be beneficial for it to maximize its effectiveness. Our interest is that because this process has taken such a long time, we would prefer to see more immediate action, SARS having its teeth more immediately, rather than having to go to the dentist, you know, for a belabored treatment that only sees those teeth arrive in a while. Nevertheless, if SARS believes that they need, that they can win further teeth through some adjustments or some amendments, we'd be willing to consider that. Nevertheless, you know, our hope is that this is a speedier process. There's been a large amount of consultation, and we'd like to see it implemented sooner rather than later.
Honourable Chair, I'm going to just focus on the two questions that were leveled to staff. The one being, are we happy with the control bill? My response to that is that it's difficult to say because, as I've said, we haven't read it. And in all fairness, when we get a chance to read it and consult and look at the impact on trade, we will be able to provide you with a definite answer. And if need be, if we have suggestions, we will provide you with suggestions on, suggestions to the draft. So that goes to our point on more time. The second issue raised was whether we need time to consult and how long do we need. As suggested in our written submission, we think a fair time would be 30 days to run from the middle of January of next year, so that it gives us all enough time to consult and then provide you with a meaty feedback and to continue the consultation process. And just to go back on the question of if we were happy with the control bill, the answer to that is, as I said, there are two issues. The inland ports, as we've been going on and on about, and we would like the opportunity to provide suggestions, recommendations on how this would work in keeping the current status quo, and not disrupting trade and not being detrimental to the city of Johannesburg in particular. And if we could touch on the issue of penalties, we'd appreciate that opportunity.
Over to you.
Thank you, Chairman. The first question I'd like to respond to is a question about the port, which is the inland port. And I think one has got to understand with the inland port, the concept is that the ship actually docks in Johannesburg. The rail train link up from Durban to Johannesburg is a continuation of the ship's voyage on the ship's manifest. So there is nothing happening in the Durban port at all on the multimodal document. Unfortunately, customs have got into the habit of intervening in the international transport documents and stopping boxes on the way instead of having them examined at City Deep, which we think highly irregular. In fact, the customs behaviour at the moment is along the lines that we are assuming City Deep doesn't exist. But that is the benefit of an inland port. You can conduct international trade from that point. It's whatever you like to call it, and it's an issue we are thrashing out at the moment. There's so many different definitions, but the bottom line is what determines an inland port is the customs endorsement granting of that point as an international gateway status. And the difficulty with the bill is not only that it's cancelling, and you've asked what proposals we've got for an amendment. We don't want to amend. What we want to do is retain the status that we've had for 36 years. have 10, are investing multi-millions. We're anticipating tremendous growth in container traffic and on a rail-based basis. Now, if the manifest is terminated at the coast, the rail movements will not take place to the great extent because the importer is not going to reconcile. And I can then lead on to the other question regarding what can we do to increase the use of rail. First of all, the intention of this bill, Chancellor City Deep Stages, will immediately move some of this 18% back onto road, because all that cargo will stop at the port. There will be less time to have it cleared. It will move out of the port, congesting the road gateways into the port. It will go into the depots, and my colleague here will confirm not one box will move by rail once it's moved out of the port. We're going to move it back into the port to take advantage of that train. So the immediate impact will be less on rail. You ask, what can we do to promote rail? What we can do, and we do try this, is to get Transnet to give a predictable, reliable service. And we're pushing that to Malepi level to get more coordination between the terminal and freight rail. They don't seem to talk to each other. And we've even been told that from freight rail, well, I don't know how long the box has been in the port before it gets onto my rail stack. So this is what we are doing to try and increase in the present environment the increase in rail. But I must tell you that to work with Transnet is not easy. But that's the comment there. And so that's the prime issue. I'd like to say that the result of the one point of disagreement we had at NEDLAC, and I want to say I sat right through all the NEDLAC process, so I know what I'm talking about. The issue, and we did resolve a tremendous amount of work at NEDLAC level, and we have tremendous cooperation with the customs, and the one sticking point was this inland port, and I can't stress the importance of it. And the result of this was at NEDLAC level, it was organised that we would have an impact assessment study. And that impact assessment study was very thorough. It involved interviews with everybody involved in the international trading cycle, and governments and shipping lines and forwarding agents and customs and everybody. And that impact assessment study has been published, and it endorses what we've been talking about today. So that work has been done. But we've all got the intention. We want the economy to work. We want to get the cost infrastructure costs down. And I can say, with my many years of experience in this business, what the customs are proposing is not going to help. And worse than that, they're not just proposing to close down existing ports, but they are building into the legislation. They are totally excluding in the legislation the possibility at a later date of creating an inland port. And we haven't had satisfactory information from customs regarding the impact this is going to have on other customs union members, and certainly how it's going to facilitate movements through our country into the inland ports in Harare and in Lusaka. And we've got tremendous competition coming now from Dar es Salaam, from Maputo. Walvis Bay is taking a lot of our traffic now because of the nonsense the importers are having with the South African authorities, and not just customs, but more important, our border police are creating tremendous problems. So this traffic is being diverted, and that's why I said in this present environment we're seeing a downturn of not just trade, but of utilisation, and we still got congestion. So I can tell you now, my question is going to be, when we have congestion surcharges introduced by the lines, if this bill goes through in its present form, who's paying? Who's going to pay that congestion surcharge?
Thank you. Honourable members and presenters from various organisations, stakeholders, in the process, I think what I would say in terms of what I think is going to happen is just the process, which is natural. And I wouldn't want to preempt what the Committee of Finance, the Senate Committee on Finance, will determine at the end of its own deliberations. Charles will be coming back next week, Gosi, and your team.
Yes, Chair. It was not our intention to respond.
I'm not asking you.
Yeah. Chair, but can I just ask one thing? We brought with us Professor Zig Eisling.
Thank you. Stop right there.
Chairperson, can I just ask? Yeah. I'm going to feel uncomfortable to see SARS first. I really need to have to give them more time. I don't know how we're going to do it, but they need more time. And secondly, I'm very uncomfortable to move with this without the input from Transnet.
Now, can I say, in terms of the determination of our program, if you have a view that says perhaps we need, the committee might need to have its own deliberation on how we take the process forward. But because this process, as much as it is new to us, the first public hearings, it's something that has been going on for quite some time, and there's no doubt about it. Every presenter said so. My view will be that let's continue as a committee. Next week we meet. Staff will be invited to that meeting. After that meeting, the committee will have its own deliberation as to whether we need to ask for further presentations or not. But I don't think we need to preempt that process, Honorable Goranov. So I think we should leave that process. In any event, I don't see us not considering what is supposed to be considered to come to the conclusion of our own process. It's quite a serious matter. It's not a matter that can just be steamrolled and so on and so forth. So in terms of our committee process, as outlined from the secretariat, is that let's meet next week as the committee, and then we'll hear what staff will have to say, and then we'll enter into our own deliberation as a committee. And I think we should end there. All our brothers?
I understand what you're proposing, but would it not shortcut the process? Would it not make it more efficient if we, as Honourable Kornoff says, summon Transnet to come? And in fact, I would go further. I would also summon the city of Johannesburg, and perhaps even the province. I would be alarmed to proceed with this without having heard from them. I understand you're saying we can decide to do that later, but it would make it quicker if we just bring them at the same time.
Okay. Perhaps let's allow those decisions to be made by the committee next week. That is a proper process. Thanks, Honourable Members. Let's break and come back at 2 to take one last item.
There's one item we're going to discuss. Which one? The parliamentary one. Thank you. Okay, we come back at 1, at 2. Thank you, Honourable.